not deserve the sufferings that they incur. You know, freedom ought to be free. And I'm trying to find my way home. The child inside me is long dead and gone. Somewhere between lost and alone, I'm trying to find my way home. Whether we lose or win, I'm so sick and tired of the spin. I don't think I can take any more. If the truth must stay in disguise, hidden beneath all the lies, then what were we fighting for? And I'm trying to find my way home. The child inside me is long dead and gone, and somewhere between lost and alone, and trying to find my way home.
That's it for Sprouts. You have been listening to Iraq Vets talking about the music that has been meaningful to them. Sprouts is distributed and coordinated by Pacifica Radio Network. Thanks to Michael Yoshida at Satellite Operations. If you or someone else at your station has a radio production that you wish to rebroadcast on Sprouts to showcase it nationally, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's Ursula, U-R-S-U-L-A, at pacifica.org. This week's producer was K.P. Whaley. I'm Catiusa Cesar in Madison, Wisconsin. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.
And coming up next on Free Radio Santa Cruz at 101.1 FM and freakradio.org, it's Bathrop Spears broadside special guest, judicial candidate Steve Wright, coming in about 7:15, 7:30. For all of you who would like to call in, the call-in number is 427-3772. We're also hoping to have a phone call-in from Michelle Waken, who has written her PhD thesis on harassment of vehicular residents in Santa Barbara, Santa Cruz, and Sonoma County. She's taken a quick trip back to Santa Cruz, and she'll be giving us kind of an update by phone, hopefully later in the show. So stay tuned, call in, and perhaps we'll also have a call from Brian Helmley. Brian's one of the Cinco de Mayo six who were arrested for cop watching in San Jose over on, well, I guess it was about 2 years ago at the big Cinco de Mayo protest against the immigration harassment, the apartheid laws of the United States, still in force. And those who watch cops apparently like to get a, you know, find, end up being abused by cops, but some can fight their way free. We'll talk with Brian Helmley about that as well. He should be calling in sometime in the next hour or hour and a half. So stay tuned.
First star I see tonight, I wish I may, I wish I might. Have the wish I wish tonight.
A banker's daughter or a runaway girl,
a little lady or a honky-tonk pearl,
has to find some place in this world where she feels at home.
A banker's daughter is so hard to
she feels at home. First time.
that was the Mamas and the Papas from their album, The Papas and the Mamas Present the Mamas and the Papas, actually from the complete anthology. The name of the song, Pearl. Welcome to Bathroom Spears Broadsides. Call-in number here again is 831-427-3772. If you want to reach me off-air, the number is 423-HUFF, H-U-F-F. HUFF is, of course, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, which is a civil rights group that meets every Wednesday in the county building. That's where we met yesterday, in the basement. We may be popping upstairs as the weather gets better. I've been threatening to do that for weeks and may actually do it. But if you're poor and homeless or you can't afford the money, we'll buy you coffee, cocoa, tea, you name it. A moderate thing to keep you interested while you contribute, if you feel like contributing. And essentially, we're concerned with civil rights restoration in Santa Cruz for all classes of people, but specifically for the poor class of people, because they're the people who usually end up with their rights stolen. We're going to be talking with Steve Wright about that. We'll see if he's the right choice for judge coming up in the Tuesday election. He's off in Watsonville, apparently, in some kind of to-do, but he said earlier when I spoke to him on the phone, he should be coming in to the studio at 7:15 or 7:30. So stay tuned if you've got questions for Steve. We'll present them to him. I've got a number of questions myself. I'm skeptical of all judges, whether they have a liberal name tag on them or not. So it's I don't intend to give anybody a free ride, and even Steve is going to have to show his stuff. Also calling in, as mentioned before, hopefully, will be Michelle Wakin, who did her PhD on RVs, as I mentioned before. And again, Brian Helmley, who recently had charges dismissed against him for resisting arrest where he was cop watching at a Cinco de Mayo protest 2 years ago. We talked to him on the air a couple of months ago. Hopefully at some point we'll actually put this stuff, it's all archived, but it's hard to find because we haven't got the names and the specific details of the shows up, and hopefully that's going to happen. We need volunteers for anybody who likes this program, wants to see it better organized, wants to volunteer to help. Do give a call to the HUFF line, 423-HUFF, 423-4833. Leave a message, leave your number, leave your email. I'll get back to you and see if we can might put you to work doing a little of this or that if you have any spare time. We're not talking about hours and hours, but a little time. So, what's happening? Well, some updates. There's some homeless people who've been coming to the HUFF meetings who have encountered some difficulties on the streets from authorities. Thomas Goodwin has been on our show. He's a vet with a speech impediment who first was hassled at the Metro, pepper sprayed at the Metro, actually. He copped a plea to that one. I think he was accused of battery or something for touching an officer or touching the security guard that pepper sprayed him. He was apparently trying to get information by his account for a bus, and he was getting the runaround and hassled, and partially because people thought his speech impediment meant perhaps he was a drunk or a drug user or something, which he doesn't seem to be, based on my experience with him anyway, at least not in terms of any kind of times I've spoken to him. More recently, he's been hassled in the vets hall, which is a broader issue, as regular listeners know. Tim Bratton, who is, I believe, a manager of the vets hall, with Overlord Pat Clark and others on the board of directors apparently endorsing Bratton's regime, has incurred the wrath of a number of vets for actions that he's undertaken involving what they feel is discriminatory behavior. Wow, that's a loud ring. Let's turn that one down a little. And Thomas is going to court. He was using the bathroom by his account, and he was hassled by somebody under Bratton's management. I'll be talking a little bit more about that. Let's see what we've got here. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Robert. It's Michelle.
Hey, Michelle. This is the notorious Michelle Wakin, who's been waking us all up, pretty much.
Thank you for that.
Yes. Well, you're sort of running around in a rented car, probably trying to check out three counties before hustling back to the East Coast. Is that the story?
That is it. Yes.
And you were here a couple years ago doing a rather extensive analysis of three counties. I think you may have talked about it a little on the air in the past. We had you on the air, right?
Yeah, you did. I think back then that was in 2005, and I was talking a little bit more about the safe parking program that exists in Santa Barbara for people living in their vehicles. and I wrote my dissertation on vehicle living there. Did extensive surveys. I think we focused more on that the last time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that in Santa Cruz, RVs are a target. Indeed, most recently, Donna Dice, who lives in her RV, and I'm going to be doing actually my first interview, is going to be some more witnessing or witness accounts around the Sergeant Lamas's assault on Donna Dice back on May 9th when Donna tried to get back into her van, essentially to leave a person who did not identify himself as a police officer by her account and by the account of other people watching. He claimed he did. Sergeant Lamas broke her arm and pulled her out of the van, slammed her down, and arrested her for resisting arrest, of course, as well as he claimed that she threw hot coffee on him. She claimed that as he pulled her out of the van, the coffee went spilling everywhere, including on her van, on the adjoining car, on her, and on Sergeant Lamas. And we've talked about this some extensively, but it has to do really at bottom with RVs and how they're treated. People who live in RVs are treated by communities like Santa Cruz. I'm particularly concerned with Santa Cruz because I live here.
Right.
And because of my listeners, many of them or most of them probably live here. And you have recently been back to Santa Cruz. You want to give us A, what you thought of Santa Cruz before, and B, what changes have happened, or you can just talk about your most recent experiences here, if you think you have stuff you want to say about that.
Well, it's always nice to come back into Santa Cruz. There's definitely, the people are very nice. I don't know, I always am looking to see what's going on with the homeless population, and the two counties that I'm comparing to Santa Cruz are Santa Barbara and Sonoma County, which is where I'm calling from right now. I guess one of the main differences is that in Santa Cruz there's a huge population of people that are living in the Greenbelt areas and come downtown for services. People who are living in their vehicles, as long as they have a current license, registration, and insurance, and they're not in the vehicle when law enforcement arrives, then they can pretty much stay there. At least that's the impression that I'm under. Although I know that there have been, you know, targeted attempts to get them out of there as well. So I guess in Santa Cruz, you know, there's a few things that are different. One, the number of people outside. Two, the sense, and I don't know where this is coming from or if it's correct, but the sense that it's a very laid-back community. And people may not want, people who are homeless may not want to go into shelters, but there's definitely the impression that it's more laid back as far as law enforcement goes. So the Dice case that you described is an interesting one because it really goes against that idea.
Yeah, I mean, we've also gotten reports that, the month before, Officer Aldridge reportedly broke somebody's finger in front of Taco Bell, a guy with his girlfriend in the backpack. He showed me the broken finger. She described what happened. I never got the story from Aldridge, and for that matter, I never got a response from Sergeant Lamas, though I approached Sergeant Lamas by leaving a message on his phone. Of course, he's a police officer, is not likely to answer this, particularly if he's guilty. I mean, you know, he doesn't want to provide more grist for a subsequent civil lawsuit, so there is that problem. You know, but in Santa Cruz, people who live in RVs have been finding themselves increasingly stressed since you were here in 2004, was it?
Me?
05. Well, since then, we've had the expansion of so-called permit parking, which not only means most ordinary people only get 2 hours to park their vehicle during the day, but bans all parking after midnight in a lot of downtown areas, university areas, beachfront areas. And thanks to Emily Riley, who's running for assembly, please vote against her in the Tuesday primary, unless you support this kind of stuff, is essentially very targeted attacks on people even parking their vehicles at night in many sections of the city, even though there's lots of empty spaces to park them, and there's no documented health or safety problem of any kind, but they openly state it's camping that they're going after. We also, of course, have the notorious 15-minute Coonerty parking lot panic law, which I talked to you about, I'm sure, and
let me ask you a question about the. So you said that there's a ban on parking on the street in some city areas after midnight?
Correct, unless you have a permit.
Oh, so if you're a resident, you can get a permit?
Correct.
Okay.
So I know that in Santa Barbara we had a very outspoken and diligent chief of the public defender's office who spent his retirement fighting for the rights of homeless people in case after case in court, and actually has had some remarkable success both with the necessity defense for people living in their vehicles,
mm-hmm.
the defense that says you can't give one tickets, people's tickets for even violating the so-called law against mm-hmm. living in your vehicle or sleeping in your vehicle if you are, in fact, you know, doing that to avoid a greater evil. And Glenn Maurer, the public defender in Santa Barbara, effectively, once he was, even while he was public defender, he was engaging in this, but I think particularly once he left, he joined the Committee for Social Justice with Peter Maron and a number of other luminaries down there, who have since, I think, since become somewhat discouraged. And, I mean, I'm more interested in what's going on in Santa Barbara, but I don't know if the audience, because I worked in Santa Barbara for a year with the Legal Defense Center of Santa Barbara as a sort of an outreach worker there, trying to, you know, mobilize homeless folks and fight their sleeping ban and their laws that criminalize the poor.
Mm-hmm.
But in Santa Cruz, there's been, in spite of your impression of a laid-back community, and apparently I don't want to disparage your experience. Your experience is your experience. You did do ride-alongs with police officers on at least three occasions, and more recently you did one when you came here. You described it for me yesterday at the Huff meeting. You want to talk? I mean, you can talk about that if you'd like. I have never been on a ride along with a police officer. I don't think I've actually formally filled out all the papers, and it does require apparently some filling out. And I know that Officer Howes, who was awarded great honors after he retired, and would not even talk to us in our group, even though we formally requested it, because he regarded us as a group of unruly dissidents. I think he has even more harsh terms for us. So we haven't, you know, I mean, I'm friendly with a number of police officers. I like a number of the cops just as human beings. But, you know, when I come across them engaging in their official harassment duties, I have no sympathy whatsoever for what they're doing. And I don't, and I make that real clear and encourage the community to show, frankly, blatant and straightforward hostility to their activity. Not because it's a matter of a personal affront or assault or criticism of the officer as a human being, but the human being is making a choice behind the uniform with the badge, the gun, the taser, the nightstick,
right,
to essentially criminalize people for things that they have to do, sleep at night, urinate, defecate somewhere,
mm-hmm.
Maybe, you know, medicate with marijuana if they use it. Hey, have a drink if they need to have a drink. All drinking is illegal, of course, if you're outside under the public open container law. What's your take on this in Sonoma, Santa Barbara, and Santa Cruz?
Well, I guess, I mean, as far as crimes committed in public, it's interesting because of the majority of crimes that are committed, most are crimes committed in public because you don't have a place to do them in private. So it's not so much that, you know, addiction and those kinds of issues don't happen with the rest of the population. It's just that they have a cover, you know, with which to hide so that those things aren't policeable. And so it's a really interesting irony. I do ride-alongs with police, but I also try to get the perspective of people living under bridges, too, or trying to access shelter services just to get, you know, two sides of the same coin, you know, people who are trying to survive and access services and try to stay clean and, you know, find a place to camp that's safe, really surprisingly end up being frightened of the police rather than viewing them as a helping, you know, agent. And, I mean, some police are more avidly pursuing homeless crimes than others. I mean, you definitely get some who are concerned, who want to help people, who want to, you know, provide them with some sort of access to resources, but then there are...
By homeless crimes, you mean crimes against the homeless, which are defined as criminal behavior in order to essentially drive homeless people away or out of sight, such as sleeping, camping, building a fire, urinating or defecating when the bathrooms are closed. These are so-called crimes that are actually, in my mind, institutional criminal hate crime against poor people.
Oh, well, yeah, there are those. Then there are also laws designed to weed out a homeless element. So there are survival-related issues, you know, like sleeping.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. I mean, I'm saying that when you say homeless crimes, Of course, you're describing it from the police point of view. I mean, from
my
mind.
I said anti-homeless ordinances. I never said homeless crime.
Oh, I'm sorry. I misheard you.
Okay.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, and I don't think I'm describing anything from the police point of view just because I did a couple of ride-alongs.
And I'm not criticizing you. I'm just saying that often when you talk about these things as crimes, because they are technically crimes, it's criminal to sleep at night in Santa Cruz after 11 o'clock at night, even though we have 1,500 to 2,000 people outside and space for 40 to 60 people in walk-in emergency shelter tonight. So,
right.
I mean,
and
it
so
is a crime to sleep outside. It's true.
It is. And so the question is, are cities going to be able to use something like the necessity defense to argue either provide more housing or allow people to camp outside or sleep outside?
And indeed, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, the Jones decision of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, the federal courts in Los Angeles, ruled that simply having a necessity defense is not enough. Police are saying, well, see, we'll arrest you for camping. We'll confiscate your gear. We'll tell you to move on in the middle of the night in cold weather. We're giving you no legal place to go. But you can sort it out later by bringing a letter to the court to prove or making a six-point necessity defense that you had a need to camp out. In Santa Cruz, it's often easier. If you bring a letter from the Homeless Service Center, generally, although it's sometimes hard to get such a letter, and also such letters are sometimes ignored by the courts, but often the courts will dismiss your sleeping ticket if you do. But the courts ruled in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, ruled in the Jones case, that that's not adequate. The very act of a police officer stopping you and saying, get up, get out of that bag, all right, I'm going to search you, I'm going to run your name. Why? Because you're sleeping here, even though you have no legal place to go. That itself is an unconstitutional violation of a person's basic rights under the Eighth Amendment, which is the right to be free from cruel and unusual punishment.
Right.
And that has changed police practices, at least under the Los Angeles sleep ordinance, the city code. And it's also changed San Diego police enforcement practices. It changed the Richmond city law, and it also changed the Fresno police practice, not to mention encouraging city authorities in Ontario, California, on the border of San Bernardino and L.A. counties to actually set up a homeless encampment for hundreds of homeless people and actually provide porta-potties and six square blocks for them to park their vehicles and, you know, cook their food and actually have a shelter of kinds, even though recently they've been cracking down on that because the shelter situation didn't develop for twice as many people as originally were there, although, for my mind, a smattering of what you know, the area could hold, considering that six acres is a lot of, or six blocks is a lot of blocks. So, I guess I was going somewhere with this. Any idea where I was going, Michelle?
I don't know. Do you think anything like that would ever happen in Santa Cruz? Has there ever been any talk of...
Thank you. I remember where I was going. We have the Jones decision. Even though it was technically vacated, it was not depublished.
Right.
So it's still on the books. Has it had an impact in Santa Barbara, Santa Cruz, and up in Sonoma counties on police enforcement and on the law?
Well, wait a minute now. The necessity defense has had a pretty big impact.
I'm not talking about the necessity defense. I'm talking about the Jones decision. Well, I'm not talking about the necessity defense, though I'm interested in that, too.
You mean the Jones case?
The necessity defense is a rather complicated defense that most homeless people don't, and most people in houses don't know how to use. It requires you got to prove affirmative. You admit you're guilty, and then you have to prove six affirmative elements to show all that stuff. Which, you know, we've actually asked judges, or we've considered presenting. We haven't actually done this, but the Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom (HUF) has said, look, we need a judge to rule that attorneys are required to present this kind of defense to the courts, and usually that's short-circuited in Santa Cruz because, as I mentioned before, the courts usually say, well, you got a letter from the Homeless Service Center saying there was no space. That's enough. But even according to the Jones decision, you don't need to prove that on the night of your being arrested by the police there was no shelter. You just have to show that generally there is a huge disparity between the amount of shelter available. And it's common knowledge that there is usually no shelter available for people. You don't have to prove you made a deliberate effort to do it. That wasn't the standard in the Jones case.
In the Jones case.
So my question is, because the Jones case was resolved in April 2006, and it was, you know, there was a settlement with Los Angeles that vacated it as a severe and binding precedent throughout the nine states where the Ninth Circuit Court holds court. In, I guess it was September of 2007, or maybe it was actually the spring of, a little later than that. But it is still, you know, for a period of time, it was precedent, and it still is persuasive precedent. Hasn't had an impact, as far as you know. Are police nervous about telling homeless people to move along for fear they may be sued, for fear they may be violating their constitutional rights, or is that still not an issue for police in these three counties?
I don't think that they would stop them because they're worried about lawsuits. I think that they would hesitate to give them tickets for something that minor because they know that they'll wind up back on the streets sooner or later, probably sooner, and they won't have really changed anything. That's certainly not all cops, nor would I have any way of gauging what they think, but from the ride-alongs that I've done this time, that's what they say.
What's changed in Santa Cruz in the last 3 years, if anything, based on your ride-alongs? Are you getting more cooperation from the Homeless Services Center authorities who, you know, get the lion's share of any homeless funding that the city kicks down, which Mayor Coonerty brags about his funding? What's your sense of what's changed? What's the positive, the negative, the good, the bad, the ugly, you know?
Well, maybe I don't. They're not all. I can't always judge every single change, whether it's good or bad, because we don't know yet. But the 10-year plan, it was formerly a 5-year plan, became a 10-year plan to end homelessness. The one thing that's interesting about that, it doesn't only focus on chronically homeless, which is kind of good, because only focusing on that population is a little limited. There are a few different programs coming online as emergency and transitional housing. I think for the first time, most counties are, and including Santa Cruz, are considering where are we actually going to put people. I mean, if we said today we were going to house the 3,000 people, you certainly couldn't build a new 3,000 units in Santa Cruz, in the city of Santa Cruz, for example. So where to spread people countywide, or where to spread the housing so that people can stay close to, you know, their families, their jobs, that kind of thing.
Well, it has been suggested by homeless activists that there's plenty of campground areas, such as Ontario, Canada set up, that could be used with clean facilities, with porta-potties and restrooms and showers set up to make room for homeless people in these straits.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, the reality is there are enough people camping out there anyway. Giving them access to places to, you know, do laundry and get clean and that kind of stuff, I mean, why not?
Well, because it would be a magnet. It would draw homeless people from all over the world to come to Santa Cruz. And also,
it would be
difficult because the police regard the sleeping van as a very useful tool in dealing with criminal problems. It also would produce all kinds of health and safety problems.
Right.
And we've got to have programs in place before we engage in such drastic solutions. Additionally, the community wouldn't stand for it. They'd shut down all the existing homeless programs because they'd be so offended. I'm giving you the arguments that are used against
I know.
You know, so that's the answer that Mike Rotkin or perhaps Mayor Coonerty would tell you. Or they would tell you, we have the best program. It's a national problem. You got to deal with it nationally. We're working as hard as we can. You know, in a year or so, we may have the shelter, the armory open during the summer so people can hop on a bus at 4, wait 2 hours, hop on a bus, go up to the armory after getting their ID checks and making sure they don't have their pets with them or any of their possessions, any more than I guess, a backpack full or less. They can't, of course, be working people because they can't really work, you know, they can't keep their job till that length of time. And,
right.
I know. Anyway, there's all kinds of absurd realities around the so-called existing programs that make them unreasonable for actually many homeless people.
Mm-hmm.
Although the common perception of the community seems to be, oh, well, you know, you have the deserving poor, and then you have those homeless by choice who are just causing problems. You've also, just to give me kind of, I guess, a description, you said that Sonoma, you talked to me about this yesterday, is somewhat more rural scene that actually provides better facilities than a place like Santa Cruz, which, who knows, Santa Cruz might have more money than Sonoma. I mean, it's probably a wealthier county, but what do I know?
What do you know is the question. In Sonoma County, there's year-round shelter, and that's really what's needed badly in Santa Cruz and Santa Barbara. And you know what? It's funny because both have emergency shelters, but either they're only open for part for the, you know, the winter months, or they're requiring people to contribute a certain portion of their income, which is fine if you do have income coming in and if it's, you know, put into an account and saved for you so that when you're able to move on to housing, then you can. Then all of that's great. But the most, the only county of the three with emergency shelter year-round is Sonoma County.
But it doesn't, it certainly doesn't have emergency shelter for everybody who needs shelter, does it?
Well, we'll find out.
I'd be very surprised. I mean, you gotta, yeah, let me know, because I'd be very surprised. I've never heard of a county.
Well,
in the United
I think they
States
require sobriety.
Right, well, required.
Before entering. So, I mean, I don't know. The question is going to be, what do you do with somebody who's actively using? I mean, there are all those kinds of questions.
Well,
so.
They don't deserve to live. It's as simple as that. Now, come on, you know, get it together, okay? We're talking with Michelle Wakin, who's, is there a place where people can actually read what you've written? Is it online anywhere? Is it available for people to scan to make sure you're not some sort of phony expert that I dragged in to?
I think if they just search by my name, it's M-I-C-H-E-L-E, the last name is W-A-K-I-N. If just Google that and it should go to something. If nothing else, they'll probably come pull up my email address and people could email me.
Well, I will Google you and find out if you're telling the truth, Michelle. Any sort
okay.
of you want to conclude with? I didn't give you much time to talk. I've talked more than you, but do you have any reactions to anything I've said or any to your experience here in Santa Cruz you want to pass on to us here?
I really like talking to homeless people in Santa Cruz. They were extremely articulate, seemed to be having a lot of, you know, fun, but they were also serious about, talked to one guy who had been on the street since 88 and has been on the waiting list for a Section 8 apartment for the past year and a half. It was really good to talk to people on the streets and see that, you know, not all of them fit the stereotypes of, you know, being inarticulate or having done something to cause themselves to be homeless. I mean, bad things simply happened to them, but they weren't, you know, even close to being beyond, you know, able to have an intelligent conversation. And I really had enjoyed the people that I met. They were also really generous in spending time with me and being willing to show me certain parts of the homeless community, even if they were worried people would think I was a cop or something like that. But people were very generous in trying to, you know, help me figure out a little bit about the community. So that was really good.
There's actually an abstract online of your ethnographic study of regulation and resistance, as you call it.
Oh,
homeless people who live in makeshift dwellings or in public shelters are subject to regulation strategies that curtail their behavior and appearance and impose control over time and access to personal information. This research examines how people living in their vehicles on a full-time basis use identity work and social ties to resist regulation, argue for status quo legitimacy, and avoid anti-homeless regulation. That's you, use ethnographic field work, including 75 surveys, 50 interviews, and data from 10 municipal court trials to present a case study of the vehicle community in Santa Barbara, California. Like many California coastal communities, the ironic existence of homeless people is troubling to citizens and city officials who seek unfettered access to beaches and shopping areas. Yet vehicles also enjoy structural primacy in the same area, which cater to a highly mobile community of tourists. This research explores how vehicle living fits in on a continuum of homeless housing solutions and answers the following questions. 1. What are the unique resources and risks that vehicle living offers in comparison with other makeshifts? 2. What is involved in acquiring and maintaining a vehicle to use as housing? And 3. How successfully do vehicle owners resist anti-homeless criminalization? Are you still pursuing these questions?
Not quite as much. I mean, it's definitely a broader study now, but I'm still looking at issues of regulation and resistance. So thematically, it's still the same.
Also, there's an article in the New York Times which mentions you.
Oh, yeah.
Keeping It Secret as the Family Car Becomes a Home, published April 2nd, 2006, for anybody who wants to check you out on the NYT. Not always the best source of information, but very prestigious, Michelle. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So that's it. That's all I've got time for right now, unless you want to gives us a dramatic new developments, like Sonoma suddenly elects homeless mayor. Or, I don't know.
What well, if anything exciting happens, I'll be sure to give you a call.
Yeah, and feel free to call in at any time with, you know, up, you know, developments. If you see national news you think is relevant, if you suddenly, I know that you were yesterday actually helping homeless people. One woman who is a plaintiff in our lawsuit against the city and its sleeping ban was who recently had a, you know, lost her pregnancy. What you were helping her try to deal with some of these issues, and
yeah,
you know, you're not just a person who's an academic who goes to the library, you know, and writes a few abstracts. You're out there on the streets, you know, and you're not just some sort of charity person. It looks like you're looking for answers to these questions and concerns.
Yeah, and you can find them in very, very different places or unexpected places. So yeah, I mean, my goal in writing and doing this work is, I mean, of course I want to publish things, but I also really want to explore this aspect of life. So, you know, hopefully the work will do that in a way that doesn't take me away from the people that I'm trying to write about. So,
well,
there's that.
Give us an email where you can be reached if people want to get in touch with you.
My email is M as in Mary, my last name, W-A-K-I-N, at BridgeW, it's BRIDGEW.EDU.
It's M. Waken at BridgeW.EDU.
Yep.
All right. Well, thanks, Michelle, for calling
from
far away Sonoma.
All right. Thank you for all the good information you provided, too.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Talk
bye.
To you later. Bye-bye. And that was Michelle Waken. You can waken, too, if you want to call in and wake us up with a couple of thoughts. You can. The phone number is 427-3772, or you're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. At 7 o'clock, we hope to have Brian Helmley calling in from San Jose on the issue of the Cinco de Mayo 6 and the recent dropping of charges for cop watching. And then at 7:30 or thereabouts, Steve Wright, candidate for the judgeship, one of the very rare judicial races that's actually being pursued as a, where the person is not an incumbent, not a person who's already in office, is actually running, and it's a contested race between him and I think it's Ari Simons. Not sure if I have her last name right. She was not invited on the air, but she is. If she wants to come on the air, if anybody knows her and wants to get the word to her, please let her know. I'd be happy to have her on my Sunday show to give a fair a balance, though frankly, I think there's too many of her kind on the bench already. And I'm not trying to be mean to her. I'm trying to be accurate and honest and unhypocritical in my position, frankly, towards almost every judge in this county, probably every judge in the state, as far as how they treat homeless people. I know their job is to enforce the law, not to make it, yada, yada, yada. Thank you very much. As far as I'm concerned, judges that enforce the drug war are guilty of criminal conduct. So we got a lot of criminals wearing black robes, as far as I'm concerned. And I'll be bringing that point up if and when Steve Wright gets here. You can, too. Call-in number is 427-3772, 427-FRSC. My name is Robert Norris. This is Bathrop Spears Broadsides. Let's jump now to the Donna Dice case. Again, the case of the woman whose arm was broken, fractured by Sergeant Christian Lamas, with apparently no consequences, no disciplinary consequences that the public knows about. He was not only stayed on the force, but he actually investigated his own case, sort of like what Deputy Chief Vogel did with his own surveillance, political surveillance of activists on New Year's Eve 2 years ago. He not only did the crime, but he investigated his own crime and found himself not guilty. And that's an interesting kettle of fish in Santa Cruz, but of course it's rather gloomy in some respects. So you can call in with your thoughts. Let's hear some more about this from some witnesses who are out there at the Three Tree Lot at Lighthouse Field where Donna was assaulted by Sergeant Lamas. That's my conclusion, and if Sergeant Lamas wants to call in to dispute that, please. I would be happy to hear his perspective on this, on how it's appropriate for a guy twice the weight, half the age, twice the size, armed to the teeth, to break an arm of a woman in order to arrest her for resisting arrest and battery, and I know later on the charge was added of marijuana. Oh, dear. So, Here's an interview that I did, I guess, about a week ago.
Chris Turner.
And Chris, you say some cops from the IA Internal Affairs Department came out to talk to you guys?
Yeah, they came out and not talked to us and asked us what
Sergeant Barry? And
I don't know. I can't remember what his name was.
How many were there?
Two.
When did they come out?
Last week.
And they came out to ask about the interaction between Sergeant Lamas and Donna Dice?
Yeah.
What went down?
Well, they just asked us questions, and we told them what we knew and what we heard, and that's about it, really. You know.
How long was the interview?
Maybe two of us, probably a good half hour.
It's always good when the police are interviewing about such things to try to have a tape recorder and record it,
yes.
Because they can put their own spin on it. Oh. Much as the IA pretends or hopes to be an independent part of the police department,
yeah,
it's part of the same police
department.
Yeah,
they didn't have any tape recorder or anything like that. They just talked to us.
Really?
Yeah.
What kind of questions did they ask?
What do you know? What have you been seeing? What do you hear? You know, stuff like that. And they said, there was one report that her arm was already hurt before the incident. I said, no, there's nothing wrong with the woman at all. You know, she was fine before the incident. Well, after the incident. So.
Did they give you a card, or did they?
I think they did, but I don't know what it did. They took our names, our height, our weight, our eye color, you know.
Did you actually see the incident yourself?
No, I didn't. I just heard about it. I had just left, and it happened right after I left.
Anybody else here interviewed is still here?
No.
Wow. Let me give you my card just in case anybody wants to, any more witnesses show up or any further things happen.
All right.
Anybody have White Dove around, by the way?
I don't know who that is.
Linda Allen?
I don't know who that is.
Another woman who was arrested that time.
And it's interesting here that the police are, when you ask for someone's height, weight, and eye color, it looks like you're treating witnesses as suspects. And I think it tends to make me wonder if the police were intimidating the witnesses in order to protect the culprit, the Sergeant Lamas. And again, I don't know. That could simply be normal procedure that's used in interviewing any witness. Or it could be a special procedure that's used to identify witnesses to police abuse or witnesses who are homeless or poor who want to be treated with some disrespect and suspicion, as I'm afraid is often the case by our police department, our sheriff's department, our Parks and Rec Ranger department.
With Joshua.
And Joshua, though, you didn't see the Dice incident. Your friend Crystal did. And also, you were present when a couple of Internal Affairs officers came out to interview you recently?
It was right after it happened. Pretty much they indicated that if the allegations are correct, which from what I heard when it happened, they are, the officers in question are pretty much in trouble. My
officers or officer?
Officer in question. Although, personally, I think trying to cover for the one would indict the others.
Well, that's already happened so many times, I think, that they're knee-deep in poo-poo and couldn't care less because it looks blue when they douse their uniforms in it. Again, that's just my prejudiced view. So, what kind of questions did they ask you?
Primarily, just a timeline. They asked me about what I heard happen, how long it was between the things that I'd heard. I heard the RV door open. I heard a car door open. It did not close. And I heard scuffling. I heard something heavy hit the ground, like somebody's body, and I heard Donna start crying. And that's pretty much all the information that I was able to give him.
Did they ask any questions that showed any kind of presuppositions or prejudices or point of view they had?
The questions that they asked, from my interpretation of the way they were asking them, it seems to not be a matter of whether or not the officer is guilty. It seems to just be a question of how much trouble he's in.
Now, again, say a little more about that. What will be the difference?
The difference would be that the questions that he would be asking would be more or less trying to indicate or seek information that would make Donna seem less plausible.
Is that what they were doing? Not what they were doing.
The first time around, that was not what they were doing. I wasn't really paying attention to the questions asked the second time around.
When was the first time around? When did that happen? Like at the time of the incident?
Literally 2 or 3 days afterwards.
And then the second time around was?
Probably about 3 or 4 days ago.
Okay. And the incident was May 9th, Friday, around 4:30 or 5. We've been talking with
Joshua.
Thank you, Joshua. Here at the Drum Circle, the Wednesday traditional event next to the farmer's market. The weather is sunny, pleasant but not hot, and the scent of marijuana smoke is in the air. Some of the concerns are that the plan is to put up a parking lot on this space. There's also a discussion, at least planned, at the Huff meeting earlier today to come here and organize a protest against the police violence against Donna Dice that happened several weeks ago out at the Three Tree parking lot near Lighthouse Field.
And this is actually what happened a week and a day ago at the farmer's market, Drum Circle right next to the farmer's market. I wasn't at the one yesterday, and Donna is apparently now finding some legal help with... It's possible that attorney Ben Rice is going to be helping her at her initial appearance in court, which is to be June 16th, I believe. If it actually happens at all, they haven't been able to find it on the calendar yet, so it's not clear that she'll actually be taken to court, though I would be surprised if she weren't, because that means the police will be facing probably a significant lawsuit, because there have been a number of attorneys, at least two I know of, who have expressed a willingness, if not eagerness, to hold the police department accountable for this kind of malicious abuse, or let's say at the very best, bald negligence. That's really pushing it and giving a lot of credit to Sergeant Lamas, where probably credit is not due. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. Call-in number here is 427-3772. My name is Robert Norris. The show goes till 8, in case you're interested. And I was kind of making a couple of announcements and updates before Michelle Wakin called in. I just wanted to, before Brian Helmley, hopefully, calls in. I suspect he will. Although twice before he hasn't, and we'll see if he actually is able to make the grade this time. I was doing an update on Thomas Goodwin, the vet who claims discrimination and harassment from employees at the Vets Hall, either egged on or controlled by or influenced by Tim Bratton. And that is an issue that I've kind of wanted to bring up with Pat Clark, who, at least as far as I know, was at least one time and may still be on the board of directors of the Vets Hall. Pat was a former candidate for city council. He's an African-American local political figure who has been working with Simba Kenyatta and Tony Madrigal, Wanda Knight and others, in a countywide coalition, which I've talked about on the air before, and there actually was a Felton meeting of this coalition recently. There'll be another one, I believe, in Live Oak area in mid-June, which I'll be announcing and talking about. And I'm actually going to talk with Brian Helmley about a similar coalition in San Jose and the perils and promise of that kind of a coalition, to use the flashy rhetoric of TV announcers. Anyway, Thomas Goodwin's going to be was actually out at during the Veterans Day Memorial Day in front of the Vets Hall, or in the Vets Hall. He's been banned from the Vets Hall allegedly for battery and trespass, if I understand properly, because he tried to get away or from a or tried to push away or some such thing a security guard who was demanding to know why he was going to the bathroom when he's a vet. And when imagines he was going to the bathroom, he doesn't want to piss on the floor. But, you know, hey, homeless people, you know, they might mess up the bathroom. I don't know if Thomas actually is homeless at the moment. He has been homeless at points in the past. And more important, he suffered discrimination as a vet. One quarter of the homeless population, according to national figures, which I don't know how accurate they are, but I read them in the papers as are homeless. One quarter of the homeless people are vets. And that's increasingly true, of course, as more homeless people are more vets are coming back from Iraq with significant disabilities. In the past wars, you know, people got shot dead or they got back and patched up. Now, you know, there's a much higher rate of survival for those of us who aren't being shot dead over in Iraq by U.S. troops. We don't forget about them. That they're not really important. They don't live here. And they're towel heads, and, you know, they got a different language, so we don't worry about them. We're over there to kill them and preserve our peace and justice and security in that country, right? Talk to Obama, talk to Clinton. You know, we're going to take our time getting out of there. But it looks like they're going to force us out of there because they're making it too expensive in many ways to stay there, which, of course, is what we should be supporting. So when anybody tells you, support our troops, turn around and say, no, I support their troops. I don't want to be an imperial occupying power. And those people who are over there doing that should have no hero status whatsoever. The following orders routine does not go over big with me. And while I'm concerned about people who are homeless and they get back, particularly vets, and I support their right to be treated decently, they're certainly not heroes for what they did. Fools, perhaps. Tools, definitely. Heroes, no, definitely not. Sorry. That one does not wash with me, and I would be happy to debate that one with anyone who wants to call in on the subject. 427-3772 is the call-in number. Let's listen to some more street interviews and learn something, maybe, or at least while away the time.
Very horny fellow here at the farmer's market.
We're talking with the Walnut Avenue Women's Support scene down here at the Farmer's Market, talking with
Vanessa.
And Vanessa, there's the 18th Annual Strawberry Festival Raffle Grand Prize. What's happening?
For the grand prize, it's dinner for two at Santa Cruz's 12 best restaurants.
Mommy, and what's one of those 12 best restaurants? Burger King?
No, not Burger King.
Oh, well.
There's lots of them. I'm not exactly sure which ones have, but almost...
Have you ever eaten at any of these restaurants?
I have not personally, but...
Let's ask this person over here. Your name, madam?
Ashley.
And Ashley, you say you've eaten at the restaurants?
I've eaten at some of them.
Now, what exactly does the Women's Center do, and why should the community support it?
Well, we help support the women of our community to help them get out of their bad situations that they're in, and because they're being abused, and help them realize that it's not fair and that they can do something about it. We aren't telling them to leave.
Domestic violence, you deal with women who are beaten up by police department officials, for instance, or...
We help women who have domestic violence, so... And
just,
some of them,
just domestic
just
violence.
Domestic violence.
So other instances of violence, oh well.
Not oh well. We'll help give them resources, but our specific center can't.
I ask, as I was called by a woman from the Women's Support Center a week and a half ago when she was trying to get assistance because she'd been beaten up by a Sergeant Christian Lamas, and she needed to get some help to get to the police station to get the relevant documents. And she was told, no, they wouldn't help her because they only deal with domestic violence. I was rather shocked to hear this, although actually not terribly much so. Because
it is unfortunate that we can only deal with domestic violence, and even...
Why is that?
Because we do need resources for everyone. Like, something that we're trying to get is men's resources, not just the Women's Center, because we can't help them.
A woman is beaten up by someone. Why should the fact that he or she has a uniform on make any difference to you?
Well, some batterers of people who are in domestic violence, some of them are police officers, and we do help them. But if it's not a domestic violence situation, we unfortunately can't help them.
Or won't help them, might be a better way of putting it, since someone could have said, sure, I'll help you if you need help getting a form at the police station, I'll go with you. But in fact, they said, we're closing for noon, get the fuck out, is what they told
them. Well, I'm sorry that person said that, but I'm...
Not in those words, but in essence, yeah, what they said.
Yeah. Well,
so that's why I'm a little reluctant to help, you know, a politically correct, hundreds of prizes, dinner for two for a year, blah, 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 because when it comes to when the river meets, you know, the rubber meets the road, what's really happening for poor women?
Well, we do try, and whoever comes to us, we do try and give them the proper resources, but sometimes it is true that we cannot help everyone.
Or choose not to help, and that's my concern. It's not a matter of cannot. You can simply walk down the street and help somebody out.
Who you talk to there.
I suppose so. Again, we've been talking with...
Huh?
Your name again?
Ashley.
Thanks, Ashley.
No problem.
All right. We're talking to that...
Technically, they're breaking the law.
So we're talking about some criminals who were rightly advised of their criminal behavior. What kind of crimes were these men involved with, John?
It was sitting on the sidewalk.
Sitting on the sidewalk?
Individually, by themselves.
And were they blocking traffic?
No.
Were they harassing passersby?
No.
Were they poo-pooing on the sidewalk?
They weren't even paying any.
Perhaps they were smoking, perhaps?
I think one of them was smoking a cigarette.
Aha! Poisoning the air, in other words.
They could be poisoning the air.
And this was in front of New Leaf. Was there a complaint?
One in front of New Leaf, one in front of Borders.
About what time of day was it?
This morning, or early afternoon.
And how many officers came up to deal with this threat?
Just one on both incidents.
The name of the officer? Who knows? Did he break anyone's arm?
No.
Well, that's good news.
That's what I was saying. He was just informing them that they were breaking
arms. All right, then. Now, what are you complaining about, for God's sake? Here's a... Well, I'm not going to talk about it.
I don't know.
What am I complaining about?
Why there's laws against sitting in Santa Cruz.
Because they want to have something to tell you to move on from. Now, keep moving, all right? Put that backpack on your... Thank you, John.
All right.
We're talking with a man who has a story for us. A man with a guitar, a man with a backpack, a man with a towel, a man with sunglasses, a man with a cap. Your name, sir?
J.P. Freeman.
And J.P., what news do you have for us? What views, what excitement, what entertainment? We're bored and cranky.
An officer who just told us we had to move along because we were standing.
Standing?
Apparently.
We couldn't stand for you, so...
We couldn't stand for a standing. So he decided to let us know that... Yes, we do live in a fascist city. Get used to it. That's a quote from one of my city employees.
I see. Now, when did this particular bit of educational process happen?
That would have been 2 days ago. It was at May 19th.
And where were you?
Downtown Pacific Avenue, somewhere between Soquel and Cathcart.
What were you doing? What time of day was it?
Mid-afternoon, standing.
And what officer gave you this piece of information?
I believe it was Officer Seeley.
Officer Seeley. He's not a sergeant yet, as far as
that
I know.
Reminded me that, or informed me that we live in a fascist society. He confirmed it.
No, I see. Well, the sergeant's trying, the officer's trying to be helpful.
He informed me. I got information from him, as well as harassment. I think that's all I have to say on that one.
All right. Well, Officer Seeley, a tip of the hat to you for adding a little bit to the store of knowledge and making the scum and the rum scums move along. We did move along then.
I did move along, or suffer fascism.
Suffer fascism, exactly. Thank you. You also, J.P., got a particular bit of information from Officer, or should I say Ranger, or Chief Ranger, John Wallace, down at the beach.
We were told if we are down underneath the wharf again that we will be arrested. I was there reading a book, sitting on a towel, by the way.
Now, was there a no trespassing sign?
No, I believe we were within our rights to be there.
Barbed wire, perhaps?
No, I think that's next.
I see. Was it in the middle of somebody's private property?
No, it's public property, best of my knowledge.
Was it 3 in the morning, and were you dealing drugs?
It was about 3 in the afternoon, and no, there were no drugs involved in any way.
Well, obviously the ranger is trying to preempt the situation to make sure you aren't tempted to engage in illegal behavior.
That might be, I guess, preemptive strike.
Exactly. It's sort of shock and awe.
Well, I was shocked. I'm not awed.
No. It's kind of more awful than anything else.
I believe you are correct on that.
Now, how many other individuals were given the similar warning?
There was like 8 of us.
Well, you were a gang of thugs. He was probably trying to stop a gang from forming that would jeopardize and threaten the community, right?
No thugs, a couple of hippies, and a few other random people.
I see. We'll have to examine that in light of your criminal record and your backpack, plus your rather provocative purple towel.
How about my lack of a criminal record?
Oh, well, we'll get into that. Some further comments, J.P.?
Yeah, it appears the authorities in the town have ramped up their harassment of the homeless in an attempt to drive us off right before the main tourist season. There are many more authorities on the street than regular. I wonder how they can afford it, since it's my money.
So we mentioned the don't stand around on Pacific Avenue, the don't sit around on the wharf. Any other concerns?
Yeah, don't sleep even in the daytime on the beach. I got woken up sleeping in the middle of the day on the beach by a towel. I don't remember his name, a local lifeguard. I don't know.
Okay, any other instances of heightened security concerns?
Their latest game is to come up to anyone with alcohol and pour it out, but not issue citations, forcing us to have to scrounge for more money, for more items, and then they play this game over and over again.
All righty.
That's all. It just seems as harassment.
So sounds like it is harassment. We've been talking with
J.P. Freeman.
Thank you, J.P. Well, we're here at the drum circle, or the jewelry circle, and we're talking with...
Hold on a second. It's going to bring just more harassment on me.
We're hoping that we can have you hung up at high noon by your fingernails, if possible.
But I don't want to be hung from the nearest telephone pole.
Are you saying you're already well hung? Oh, ho.
I think
bragging again, eh?
I think the officer was correct in one thing. He said it's my cross to bear. I don't know if I want to bear that cross.
You said you just came back to town. You were out in three trees, and the police welcomed you back with a special greeting.
Yeah, apparently, he claimed that the police was called on me, that somebody called 911 and reported somebody waving a jar amongst, or allegedly, possibly doing something that could be construed as being some type of solicitation of some sort.
In other words, you were accused of dealing drugs?
Well, I don't think I was accused, but insinuated that the caller who was lurking about had called the police and reported suspicious activity involving marijuana.
I see. Did you pop out your marijuana card and show it to him?
No, I never got that far.
All right, but in fact, you have one.
I changed the subject to the fuel efficiency of the Prius that I was driving.
Clever move on your part, Brian.
Well, you know, you do what you can do.
I want to say that, actually, I don't think it was your account at City Council of the Donna Dice broken arm by Sergeant Lamas that did it, but a later account by Bernard Klitzner of the Human Rights Organization that evening prompted a City on the Hill Press reporter to actually do a story, which may be coming out shortly.
I was on the freeway when she called. I was unable to talk to her because I was driving on the freeway.
Ah, bummer.
And she was supposed to call me back, but she never did.
Yeah, she had a deadline, and who knows, maybe it'll end up being a dead number, but we'll see. Thank you. We've been talking with...
But luckily, the officer was nice and friendly, and he let me go, and didn't search me or demand anything other than identification.
How nice of the nice officer. Thank you, Brian.
You're welcome.
All right, Mr. Jeweler Man, do you have some comments for Free Radio?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that we don't want any chemicals in our food, and we don't want any chemtrails in our skies, and we don't want Babylon listening to our phone calls, and we want freedom of speech, and we want to be able to breathe clean air without feeling like we're going to get pulled over for driving to the freaking grocery store. We want to be able to sell our jewelry and our artwork with free rights, because we are free people in America, and we want to be free. Thank you very much, and I love you all.
Thank you. Well, it's a sunny Thursday morning. About 11, we're talking with...
Patty,
you got a signed spare change, thanks, and a big double gulp and a couple of bags, but you might not have slept too well last night.
Right. There's one problem. You know, the cops, they don't think ahead, you know. They treat you like you're sleeping in front of the building instead of the back. You know, I had a real nice place to sleep. I had permission to be there. They tell me, oh, it's government or whatever, go sleep in a parking lot, right? So I had to change my whole world around to go please this man, you know, if you want to call him that. And so now I'm sleeping in a parking lot where I get dew on me, you know. And plus there's cars that back up a lot, you know, in the middle of the night. They come and park illegally too, right? So the cops are putting us more in situations where before we were out in the woods, they forced us to come into town. And they chase us out of town and put us in dangerous sleeping situations. You know, I really regret the fact that I'm sleeping in this parking lot. I could get run over or something. They don't even think like that. They're just making the problem worse.
What do you think of the idea of a mass protest at City Hall and a sleep-in there?
Well, yeah, that's what we need, like, a 24-hour shelter where there's not, oh, you know, drug reform, you know, you got to go out there and work while I sit inside and make money telling you to go out and work. You know, that's not right. We need a place where everything's mellow, where where the shelter is there for you and there's some food, you know, because there's a problem out here. And the more money you get, you know, the more the problem arises. They take half your check, this and that. They want you to pay every month for your car. This is fucked.
We've been talking with...
Patty.
Thanks, Patty. There is a meeting, of course, every Saturday at the Firefly Cafe, if you ever get interested. Free coffee, 2 o'clock. And we're talking about organizing a kind of a Homies for the Homeless protest like we did last year. I just talked to a guy, Les, who seems to be interested.
But it depends a lot on what people want to do and how much, how energetic they are, how much they want to put on the line, because, you know, it does involve a certain amount of exposure. But
we just need these freaks off the streets telling everybody what to do. You know, I think the homeless are all right. There's people that are worse off than the homeless, and they're telling us what to do and taking our stuff and, you know, telling us where to sit. And that isn't right. You
talking about police and hosts?
Exactly. Yeah, they're worse off than the homeless, you know.
Oh, you are just such a cynic. Try to follow orders, will you?
Yeah, thanks, Robert.
Thank you.
And now a much-needed musical break. Stay tuned. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. It looks like hopefully Brian Helmley will not crap out again, but this could be his third strike. He's supposed to be calling in today, but he has trouble remembering or possibly who knows what's happening. Anyway, we'll keep hoping, and there's a longer show on Sunday, so we'll provide yet another opportunity as we trudge into the future. Here's another quickie from the Mamas and the Papas.
She wants to be on stage, front page, outside the dotted line. You know I'm gonna shine. She just needs that. To start my new career, you'll see that I'm sincere and I won't blow it. Mr. Director, please don't reject her till you've heard her. Seduce her till you've heard her sing,
and everything in your new production.
She got to be hot stuff, real tough.
I wanna be photographed. Asked for
Mamas and the Papas. The name of that one is I Want to Be a Star. You too can be a star on Free Radio, at least for a few minutes, as you sound off and we chatter, debate, and get into it. Here's a story from CommonDreams.org called Immemorial Day, or War Immemorial Day, No Peace for the Militarized U.S. by Bill Quigley. Memorial Day is not actually a day to pray for U.S. troops who died in action, but rather a day set aside by Congress to pray for peace. The 1950 Joint Resolution of Congress, which created Memorial Day, says, quote, requesting the President issue a proclamation designating May 30th, Memorial Day, as a day for a nationwide prayer for peace. And that, of course, was, I think it was this year, was May 26th, 25th. It was last Monday. It's migrated from May 30th. Peace today is a nearly impossible challenge for the United States. The U.S. is far and away the most militarized country in the world and the most aggressive. Unless the U.S. drastically and dramatically reduces its emphasis on global military action, there will be many, many more families grieving on future Memorial Days. The U.S. spends over $600 billion annually on our military, more than the rest of the world combined. China, our nearest competitor, spends about one-tenth of what we spend. I'm not vouching for these figures, and they could be wrong, but I've heard similar figures propounded before. The U.S. also sells more weapons to other countries than any other nation in the world. The U.S. has about 700 military bases in 130 countries worldwide. I heard it was 747 or some such. And another 6,000 bases in the U.S. and our territories, according to Chalmers Johnson in his excellent book, Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic. The Department of Defense, DOD, reports nearly 1.4 million active duty military personnel today. That's U.S. military personnel. Over a quarter of a million are in other countries, from Iraq and Afghanistan to Europe, North Africa, Southeast Asia, and the rest of the Western Hemisphere. The DOD also employs more than 700,000 civilian employees. The U.S. has used its armed forces abroad over 230 times, according to researchers at the Department of the Navy Historical Center. Their publications list over 60 military efforts outside the U.S. since World War II. And I'm going to read some of those in a moment. While the focus of most of the Memorial Day activities will be on U.S. military dead, no effort is made to try to identify or remember the military or civilians of other countries who have died in the same actions. For example, the U.S. government reports 432 U.S. military dead in Afghanistan and surrounding areas, but has refused to disclose civilian casualties. "We don't do body counts," General Tommy Franks said. Most people know the deaths in World War I, 116,000 U.S. soldiers killed. But how many in the U.S. know that over 8 million soldiers from other countries and perhaps another 8 million civilians also died during World War I? By World War II, about 408,000 U.S. soldiers were killed. Worldwide, at least another 20 million soldiers and civilians died. The U.S. is not only the largest and most expensive military on the planet, but is also the most active. Since World War II, the U.S. has used U.S. military force in the following countries. 1947 to 49, Greece. Over 500 U.S. Armed Forces military advisors were sent into Greece to administer hundreds of millions of dollars in their civil war. 1947 to 49, Turkey. Over 400 U.S. Armed Forces military advisors sent into Turkey. 1950 to 1953, Korea. In the Korean War and other global conflicts, 54,246 U.S. service members died. 1957 to 1975, Vietnam. Over 58,219 U.S. killed. 1958 to 1984, Lebanon. 6th Fleet Amphibious Marines and U.S. Army troops landed in Beirut during their civil war. Over 3,000 U.S. military participated. 268 U.S. military killed in bombing. 1959, Haiti. U.S. troops, Marines, Navy land in Haiti and joined in support of military dictator François Papadoc Duvalier against rebels. 1962, Cuba. Naval and Marine forces blockade island. 1964, Panama. U.S. troops stationed there since 1903. U.S. troops used gunfire and tear gas to clear U.S. canal zone. 1965-66, Dominican Republic. U.S. troops land in the Dominican Republic during their civil war. Eventually, 23,000 were stationed in their country. 1969-75, Cambodia, U.S. and South Vietnam. Jets dropped more than 539,000 tons of bombs on Cambodia. Three times the number dropped on Japan during World War II. 1964-1973, Laos. U.S. flew 580,000 bombing runs over the country. More than 2 million tons of bombs exploded, double the amount dropped on Nazi Germany. U.S. dropped more than 80 million cluster bombs on Laos. 10 to 30% did not explode, leaving 8 to 24 million scattered across the country. Since the war stopped, two or three Laotians are killed every month by leftover bombs. Over 5,700 were killed since the bombing stopped. 1980, Iran, Operation Desert One. 8 U.S. troops died in a rescue effort. 1981, Libya. U.S. planes aboard the Nimitz shot down two Libyan jets over the Gulf of Sidra. 1983, Grenada, U.S. Army and Marines invade, 19 U.S. killed. 1983, Lebanon, over 1,200 Marines deployed into the country during their civil war, 241 U.S. service members killed in bombing. 1983 through 1991, El Salvador, over 150 U.S. soldiers participate in their civil war as military advisors, not to mention the millions of dollars spent supporting the dictatorship there. 1983, Honduras, over 1,000 troops and National Guard members deployed into Honduras to help the Contra war against Nicaragua. 1986, Libya, U.S. naval strikes hit hundreds of targets, airfields, barracks, and defense networks. 1986, Bolivia, U.S. Army troops assist in anti-drug raids on coca growers. 1987, Iran, Operation Nimble Archer, U.S. warship shelled two Iranian oil platforms during the Iran-Iraq War. Of course, we're not talking about Rumsfeld's handshake with Saddam Hussein and the funding of Iraq in its war against Iran throughout the 80s. 1988, Iran, U.S. naval warship Vincennes in Pacific Gulf shoots down Iranian passenger airliner Airbus A300, killing all 290 people aboard. U.S. said it thought it was an Iranian military jet. 1989, Libya, U.S. naval jets shoot down two Libyan jets over the Mediterranean. 1989 through 1990, Panama, U.S. Army, Air Force, and Navy forces invade Panama to arrest President Manuel Noriega on drug charges. U.N. puts civilian death toll at 500. 1989, Philippines, U.S. jets provide air cover to Philippine troops during their civil war. 1991, Gulf War, over 500,000 U.S. military personnel involved, 700-plus U.S. died. 1992 through 93, Somalia, Operation Provide Relief, Operation Restore Hope, and Operation Continue Hope. Over 1,300 U.S. Marines and Army Special Forces landed in 1992. A force of over 10,000 U.S. was ultimately involved, over 40 U.S. soldiers killed. 1992 through 96, Yugoslavia, U.S. Navy joins in naval blockade of Yugoslavia and Adriatic waters. 1993, Bosnia, Operation Deny Flight. U.S. jets patrol no-fly zone. Naval ships launch cruise missiles, attack Bosnian Serbs. 1994, Haiti, Operation Uphold Democracy. U.S.-led force of 20,000 troops invade to restore the president. 1995, Saudi Arabia, U.S. soldier killed in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, outside U.S. training facility. 1996, Saudi Arabia. 19 U.S. service personnel die in blast at Saudi airbase. 1998, Sudan, Operation Infinite Reach, U.S. cruise missiles fired at pharmaceutical plant thought to be terrorist center. 1998, Afghanistan, Operation Infinite Reach, U.S. fires 75 cruise missiles on four training camps. 1998, Iraq, Operation Desert Fox, U.S. naval bombing Iraq from Striker jets, and maybe Stinky as well, and cruise missiles after weapons inspectors report Iraqi obstructions. 1999, Yugoslavia, U.S. participates in months of air bombing and cruise missile strikes in the Kosovo War. That's one where a bunch of us got arrested at FAR's office protesting that bombing. 2000, Yemen, 17 U.S. soldiers killed aboard U.S. Navy-guided missile destroyer USS Cole, docked in Aden, Yemen. 2001, Macedonia, U.S. military lands troops during their civil war. 2001 to present, Afghanistan, Operation Enduring Freedom, includes Pakistan and Uzbekistan with Afghanistan. 432 U.S. killed in these countries, another 64 killed in other locations of Operation Enduring Freedom. Guantanamo Bay, Djibouti, Eritrea, Ethiopia, Jordan, Kenya, Kyrgyzstan, Philippines, Seychelles, Sudan, Tajikistan, Turkey, and Yemen. U.S. military does not count deaths of non-U.S. civilians, but estimates of over 8,000 Afghan troops killed, over 3,500 Afghan civilians killed. 2002, Yemen, U.S. Predator drone jets missile attack on Al-Qaeda. 2002, Philippines, U.S. sends over 1,800 troops and special forces in mission with local military. 2003 through 4, Colombia. U.S. sends in 800 military to back up Colombian military troops in their civil war. 2003 to present, Operation Iraqi Freedom, or is it Operation Iraqi Liberation? That's oil, of course. They called it freedom instead of liberation. 4,082 U.S. military killed. British medical journal Lancet estimates over 635,000 civilian deaths. That's as of 2006. Iraq body count estimates over 84,000 civilians killed. 2005, Haiti. U.S. troops land in Haiti after elected president forced to flee. 2005, Pakistan. U.S. airstrikes inside Pakistan against suspected al-Qaeda, killing mostly civilians. 2007, Somalia. U.S. Air Force gunship attacks suspected al-Qaeda members. U.S. Navy joins in blockade against Islamic rebels. The U.S. has the most powerful and expensive military force in the world. The U.S. is the biggest arms merchant, and the U.S. has been the most aggressive in worldwide interventions. If Memorial Day in the U.S. is supposed to be about praying for peace, the U.S. has a lot of praying and changing to do. That's by Bill Quigley, human rights lawyer, law professor at Loyola University, New Orleans. His email is Quigley, Quigley, 77 at gmail.com. And this story, which is entitled Immemorial Day, No Peace for a Militarized U.S., was published Monday on commondreams.org. So, let's take another brief musical break, and then we'll hear some more interviews, and who knows, maybe Steve Wright will show up at the studio or call in. We'll see. Grasshopper, Another Mamas and the Papas song. You're going to be getting lots of those around 8 when Uncle Dennis comes in with his From the Cream to the Dregs. For all you old-timers who want to hear stuff from the 60s and 70s, stay tuned. However, we now have a new-timer here who's probably younger than I am, but probably older than you are. Who knows what the average age is out there. Steve Wright, who is running for Municipal Superior Court Judge here in Santa Cruz. I guess you're taking, what, Danner's seat, or whose seat are you taking?
Actually, this is for Judge Stevens, who's retiring.
Judge Stevens.
At the end of his term, which is ends in December.
Stiletto Stevens, eh? Yeah, I have names for all these judges. Okay. I don't think much of them. And, I mean, although Stevens at times has made some good decisions, I'm not a fan of the courts generally, mainly because they tend to treat homeless people very badly and poor people very badly as a matter of course. But before I get into my rap, this is your election eve, well, 4 or 5 days before you actually go to the polls, or we all go to the polls on Tuesday. What makes this election different than other elections for judges?
Well, it's really rare that there is an election for judges. All the judges we have now, all 10 of them, have been appointed by the governor.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a political process that you go through, and you need to be political, and you need to be the right political party in order to get those appointments. And this, because of the timing of Judge Stevens' retirement, this became an open election.
Is this a plot on Stevens' part?
No, you know, I think he's ready to retire. There was no reason for him to run for re-election. If he had retired early, his retirement wouldn't have fully vested. If he had run, he would have extended past his 20-year vesting, and it would have been, and then retired several months later to let the governor appoint. And I think that he saw this as a chance to let the community decide on who they want for a judge.
So what's the time frame? When do you have to retire in order to get an election that will actually be rather than an appointed person?
Yeah, it's just the way your retirement works. Any judge could do this if they timed it right, okay, if they retired after their term, okay? So Stevens, 20 years you fully vest. This will be 20 years at the end of December for Stevens, and that's when his term expires. So a new judge will take over in January. And
wouldn't the election be in November then?
No. Well, it could be, but there's only two people running. So one of us is going to win in June. And
even
so,
though he'll go on until November.
And even though Judge Stevens will continue through December, and whoever the winner is, they won't take the bench for 6 months.
And if he'd wanted to avoid this kind of an election, maybe get one of his incumbent pals to win or something, or get an appointment from the governor, who then would become the incumbent and hence the favored person, how would he have managed it? How would he have done that?
He would have had to run for re-election, then extended past December, and some months down the line retired, and then that spot would be open for appointment.
I see. So in essence, he's not retiring until the end of his term, but he's announced it in advance, so there's going to be an election on that issue.
He announced that he is not running for a re-election.
Right, and therefore...
So therefore it was open.
So no judge has really done that and said, I'm not running for re-election since in the last 20 years.
It's extremely rare. And I know of no other election in Santa Cruz County history where there's been a vacancy on the bench and not a judge incumbent, or at least one of the candidates as a judge.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a rare occasion where you have two people running, both are lawyers, neither one are judges.
You have to be a lawyer to be a judge.
You have to be
correct?
A lawyer to be a judge, yeah.
So I guess I'm out, as are 90% of my friends.
Unless you change the law.
Unless I change the law, right.
Right.
There's some states where you can, you know, be a legislator, or you can certainly be a legislator without being a lawyer, but you can be a judge without being a lawyer in some states, I think.
I've heard that.
But I'm not quite sure what states those are. Maybe I'll move there. You never can tell.
Robert, you're not moving anywhere.
Probably not, no. I'm too tired to do anything at this point. The last contested election I remember having any interest in was the Watts election of, I don't know, 1992 or something. Commissioner Watts was running against Mike Barton, who I called Barracuda Barton. And actually some people have been very praised him, like Richard Quigley liked Barton a lot. I thought, Barton has done a couple of good decisions, you know, but the problem generally with these judges are they don't want to challenge the political establishment around issues that, for example, to me are rather obvious. Like the one that I keep bringing up is the sleeping ban in Santa Cruz, which is an infraction law. It's not really a big deal in a certain sense, but it does show up in courts because when you disqualify the referee or the lower commissioner, you get to a judge. And when you get to a judge, the issue of the constitutionality of this ordinance comes up. And this is the ordinance that says, after 11 o'clock at night in Santa Cruz, thou shalt not sleep on any public property or in your own vehicle, even if it's legally parked, or on much private property unless you are inside a house or hotel. You can't sleep on your own property, for instance, even on your own private property if you are in a front yard, if you're in a detached garage, if you're in an office building. And what that does for 1,500 to 2,000 homeless people, as regular listeners of this show know, is it makes it illegal for them to sleep at night, literally. And if they want to follow the law, they should walk around all night till 8:30 in the morning and then go to sleep in the parks. As a judge, I should say as a lawyer, once you lose this race for judge, if you do, does this concern you? Because you probably heard about a sleeping ban lawsuit against this happening. And, you know, it's been ruled unconstitutional in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I'm aware of that. I have not read the decision, but I'm aware of it. It's the Ninth Circuit Jones decision.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
I have not read it, and I need to read it. You know, Robert, the issue of safe places to sleep and the homeless sleeping ban has been a big issue in this community forever. At least, I don't know how long it goes back, but it seems like the ban was in the mid-'80s or so.
78.
Okay, mm-hmm. When it came in. Mm-hmm. And it is... you know, it's always been a concern of mine. I think everybody, my concern is that people have a safe place to sleep. And that they also, and we don't have enough places for people to sleep safely. And there needs to be some solution. And I don't know what it is.
It's interesting. Judge Kelly, you know, would have agreed with you. We used to go before him. He's a nice guy. I like Judge Kelly. Although I call him Kangaroo Kelly for a number of reasons, and he used to give me a pass as a correspondent for what I call the Street Shit Sheet, which was a homeless newsletter I put out. I had a parking pass until the administration of the parking area kind of preempted the judges on this some years later. So, I know though that even somebody like Kelly, when the issue of the constitutionality of the sleeping ban, which seems to me to violate the right to travel, the right to be free from cruel and unusual punishment, the right to due process of law, the right to substantive due process, the right to equal protection of the laws, a variety of federal and state constitutional provisions, you'll get Kelly saying, well, they can sleep during the day, can't they, and therefore it's okay.
Yeah.
Now, you don't know. The case hasn't been brought before you. You haven't read the law. You probably haven't thought about it in any legal detail. And you would have to be brief from both sides anyway if you were a judge to give a fair decision. But to say that that we need safe places to sleep is what the city council has always used as its out. They have said, oh, we don't want to have people sleep outside. We want good, affordable housing for people. Until that day comes, we'll just keep arresting them for sleeping outside. I feel that as a judge, I would like the man I vote for to be able to say, I don't know how I'm going to vote on how I'm going to rule on this, but I would have some concerns about this law at least.
It's when I was in about 30 or so at law school, I thought I had all the answers to everything.
I'm 60 and I think
now
I know the answer.
As I'm in my mid 50s, I'm realizing I don't even know all the questions. But the one trait I have is that I'm willing to listen, and I'm not claiming to have the answers, and I will, and there are a lot of things that I don't or haven't come to formalized opinions on, and when I reach an opinion, it's just that. It's my opinion based upon the information I have at that time, mm-hmm. and subject to change, and with more information and more dialogue and more study, you know, and that's the way I would be on the bench, and I would... You know, anything I do, I'm willing to give everybody a clean, fair hearing and a fair shot.
Mm. But you're not talking about the substance of the issue at all, I notice.
You know, the substance of the issue is I can't, as a judge or a judge candidate, I can't predict. I can't talk about issues that could come before the court and say, this is how I rule. because
isn't that what they used to say when the Supreme Court justices went before Congress? But in fact, when asked to judge by your past experience, we got a caller here.
Right.
Hey there, caller. You're on Free Radio with Steve Wright, who is a candidate for a judge in a contested election coming up on Tuesday. Hi. Sorry.
Robert, it's Yon.
Hey, Yon, what's up?
Well, I called in to ask a question to Mr. Wright.
Go ahead.
Okay, I guess I got to turn down this.
Definitely. To all people listening, when you call in, turn down your radio or you'll get confused. We have a delay.
Robert, it's Yon. Hey, Yon.
Indeed. We're aware of that.
Well, Mr. Wright, my name is John Galder. I've spent quite a bit of time pro se in Santa Cruz Superior Court, and some pro bono work for people, and getting to the point where I know the law pretty well, and mostly fighting some infractions for people. And generally speaking, I do a peremptory challenge in traffic court because I don't feel it's possible at all to get a fair hearing in traffic court. I think I've gotten one once, but it seems like a very one-sided thing that's too time sensitive, and you can't present any real motions in there and expect to get them heard. So in the process of challenging citations, I have focused for quite a while on the issue of whether there's a verified complaint, because I feel that constitutionally and with due process, it's a very important part of the process. And I see that through the traffic court, it is essentially every essential part of the process has been shortcutted, and most people get to traffic court having a clue what their rights are despite what the judge is required to tell them in the beginning of the session. So my question to you is, I've made the verified complaint challenge to citations a number of times, and I've gone quite a ways with it. And the last time I was in court on this, the DA's representative asked for a sidebar. And in that sidebar, she looked at me and the judge and said, the people will no longer be arguing this case, Your Honor. In fact, we will no longer argue any case brought up from traffic court to superior court. And so I looked at her, and at the time I was arguing a motion for dismissal for lack of verified complaint.
We should explain to listeners that verified complaint is a sort of more elaborate, very specific set of charges which a defendant is read, rather than, let's say, being handed a ticket from a police officer where you come in and you just show the ticket. And in most cases, the procedures in Santa Cruz courts and elsewhere is to not require verified complaints for infraction offenses. That's my understanding.
Well, yeah, but my understanding of the law is that whether it's under the penal code or under the vehicle code, a verified complaint is if the defendant pleads not guilty a verified complaint is required and may be requested. So on this sidebar, she made the statement, I said, and then I looked at her and I
got to get
well,
to the question, you know.
I said, are you going to not oppose my motions, and are you going to refused to respond to my motions? And it's my understanding that the judicial system we have is an adversary system, so that if one side steps away from the contest, if you make any kind of a cogent legal argument, you should win in absence of opposition. So the judge looked at her, and of course she didn't have the answer to that, and I made a good what I considered a good argument for a verified complaint, which is actually quite simple.
Yon, you got to get to the question.
I'll get right away.
You got 20 seconds, and I'm moving on.
All right. Well, so my question is, do you think that the constitutional requirement of a verified complaint, that the complaint actually be sworn before an officer of the court, because that's what the law says, is one that should apply, that I mean, I don't see any place where it shouldn't apply.
All right, let's ask him that question. Steve, any thoughts on that? Give him a chance to answer you. Go ahead,
yeah.
Steve.
You know, the difference between a citation to appear and a verified complaint is procedural, basically. If a person, if you make a motion to require a verified complaint and a verified complaint is then filed, that satisfies your motion.
But they didn't file a verified complaint. They simply called it a verified complaint. It was not sworn before an officer of the court. And the DA's office is actually allowed to do that.
The question for our listeners is, what difference does it make? I mean, that's the issue.
Here's the difference I see it makes, because you're talking about, you're taking the notice to appear, which is just information that the officers put down, and the DA is, without any investigation, is swearing that that's true. They haven't talked to the officer. They don't have any facts or circumstances really written down, and they're swearing that that's true. But they're not swearing. It's a self-sworn statement. So the only person involved here is some DA staff who's never talked, has no connection with the case. And on that basis, they can put you in front of a judge for a penal matter, and that's the basis of the issue I have, that you can be accused of something with somebody who has no connection whatsoever with the facts and has not sworn.
Okay, let's get Steve's thoughts on that. Thank you, Jan. Go ahead.
In criminal cases, most of the time, the citations to appear are a benefit to a defendant because it eliminates the requirement of going to jail. If they arrest you and release you, in almost every case, then you'll receive a verified complaint when you get to court. You could require a verified complaint in citation offenses. It would extend how many times you would have to go to court, and of what real benefit it is, I'm not sure. If you're attacking every procedural aspect of any case, then that might be a process you want to make them go through, because you want to make them do everything that's possibly required, so that they know when they continue to do this, they're going to have a lot of work on their hands.
Well, that's exactly my strategy. But the other part of it, Mr. Young, White,
Young, this is your, you got 30 seconds. And we're going to the next caller.
The other part of it is that if you don't have any facts or circumstances in the complaint, and you certainly don't have any really in a notice to appear, you don't really know how you're going to deal with your defense, and they don't want to go through any of that too. They don't want to go through a pretrial with an infraction. They don't want to go to that trouble. But you have lots of rights to subpoena people and ask pretrial questions and most people are never going to do this. I understand, but you have the right to do it, and if you can force a verified complaint, then those rights become useful.
Thank you, Young.
Yes.
Steve, I mean, I've had long conversations with Yon on this and other subjects, and I think his point is to preserve the rights of the ordinary citizen in court against the presumption of guilt that sort of comes up, even though there's supposedly a presumption of innocence, and allows the DA to kind of short-circuit this stuff and proceed without, you know, any kind of check. Are you saying that as a judge, if a case came before you or an infraction for a verified complaint was sought, your understanding now, though you might change your minds hearing more information, is that you would require a verified complaint, or you would be sympathetic to that argument, or what's your feeling about that?
I think I would. I may question about the need for it. I may question the wisdom of it. I may question the but if they are legally entitled to a verified complaint, I'd require it.
Are people who have infraction offenses legal?
You know, I'm not sure about that. That's what I'm not sure about.
That's the issue that Yon was raising.
Infraction versus misdemeanor.
That's the key issue. Because most people come to court in Santa Cruz on infractions.
Yeah, I understand.
And it's kind of like a fine-making machine for whoever. In other words, police officers are sort of assumed to be correct. And
I understand.
Most people, even if they take it to trial, will lose. You have no right to a jury trial. You have no right to a public defender. You know. To a transcript or have a public recorder, but I think that you now can get that if you disqualify the referee. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Steve Wright. Hello, turn down your radio.
I did, I think.
Okay, all righty.
Hi, Robert.
Hi.
Guess who?
You tell me.
I saw you in Long's the other day. Guess who?
Oh, Oh, yeah. Okay. I've forgotten already, but...
forgot my name. Oh,
I forget
man,
everybody's
I'm
name. You know, I'm not even going to tell you how old I am. It's, I'm getting so old, I don't even care about it anymore.
Hey, excuse me. I think I'm older than you.
It could be, but listen, why don't you... Steve is younger than both of us. So tell this youngster what your question is.
Well, I didn't really have a question.
Or
I kind of had something to tell you about.
All right.
Did you know that they opened the new bay over here at the shelter? I mean, not grand opening, but kind of had people over here yesterday.
You mean the bay that replaces the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program?
Correct.
No, I hadn't heard about that. And it's interesting to hear. I know that. Do you know how many spaces there are for people tonight? Because that was the issue I was raising with Steve earlier.
Well, all I know is if they're still doing the church groups. They haven't actually opened it up to clients yet. I think it's going to be sometime next week.
Okay.
I'm not sure yet.
All righty. Well, I appreciate that information. Anything else you want to report on?
No, not really. Just kind of just hanging around. You know,
cool.
Getting myself into trouble. But as soon as I find out when exactly that's going to happen, I'll call you ahead of time on the Huff line.
Fair enough.
And maybe you can come over and, you know,
yeah,
you
make
can
it come
talk into people.
Yeah, I mean, it's important information, and thank you for letting me know, Linda.
No problem, hon.
All right, babe. An issue, Steve, that concerns me is the drug war in Santa Cruz. Another issue is the right to jury nullification. The drug war takes up a huge amount of resources, and it's funded by federal grants. It funds police departments. D.A. Bob Lee continues to harass medical marijuana growers and cultivators who are outside the city limits, like the Hemporium, Roger Minch, who he pursued for 2 years, claiming that, for example, medical marijuana dispensaries are not legal under state law because they don't involve caregivers and caretakers. It does say it's not legal, even under measure Proposition 215 and SB 420, to do that. This flies against the sentiments of the community, of the county, of the city. You're a judge. What do you think of the drug war? I hope I'm not going to get a stonewall answer on this one.
No, it's I'm also a child of the 60s. And,
a child of the 80s, I think, would hopefully have the same point of view if he wasn't, you know, cocaine-addled or something.
And with, you know, the issue of marijuana is a very, very low priority for me. It's something that I think should be legal.
Mm-hmm.
I agree 100% with medical marijuana. I believe that, you know, I wish it all just be legal right now. And to harass people is for marijuana is I have a hard time. I've had some cases recently where I represented a young man who had 14 grams mm-hmm. of marijuana in his car, never been arrested before, never had a problem, was arrested for transportation because his car was moving. He was thrown in jail, $25,000 bail, and it had
in
a horrible...
In Santa Cruz County.
It wasn't in Santa Cruz, but a kid from Santa Cruz.
Huh.
It had horrible ramifications on his athletic career. And when I heard about it, got in touch with the district attorney, they looked at it, they went, oh, my God, we did this. And it ended up being reduced to an infraction with a $100 fine, but we went to a class and got dismissed instead. But that didn't take the process from headlines in the paper of $25,000.
How much did it cost this guy to get your services and also get pay all the costs?
Nothing.
Really? You did it pro bono?
Yeah.
Good for you. But you're going to be a judge. You're a judge. Are you going to stand against the drug war? And are they going to say, you're not following the law, Mr.
I can't.
Mr.
I can't
judge.
Make the law. I can't change the law. I have to work within the boundaries of the law. It is an issue that's very, very important to me. And I will like to work these cases out as reasonably as possible within the sentiments of the community.
I mean, we have, for example, Craig Canada, who's a homeless man. I'll show you a copy of the law. Actually, the woman who wrote the story about his case has just entered the studio, Linda LeMaster. Welcome, Linda, to Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Hi, everyone. Nice to meet you, Steve.
And Linda is a former city council candidate, chair of the former Homeless Issues Task Force, and writer and activist. But the issue of medical marijuana for homeless people is a very significant one that judges are going to be confronted with because the DA's office has shown no disinclination to proceed on these issues. Apparently they feel it's okay to proceed this way. And I guess my question to you is, as a judge, you'll be offending DAs, you'll be offending the police departments, you'll be offending the sheriff's office, and you'll be offending your fellow judges who are appointed by the governor and who are mostly, almost entirely, with a few exceptions, former prosecutors. Are you going to, I mean, I remember what I call the guy I call Many Faces McAdams, the only public defender for many years, who tried even harder to show he was tough on this and tough on that. You're going to be, you know, are you going to have to show you're tougher than the rest of these guys? Am I going to have to worry about that when if I vote for you?
I'll be tough on violent crime, I promise you.
How about the drug war?
And the drug wars is an issue that I do not seek punitive punishments. I can just tell you that I have a different life experience than anyone else I know that's ever been a judge in this county. And those life experiences are important to me as to how I view this world and how I view my cases. I will do what's right because that's how I sleep at night.
And that's pretty vague, unfortunately. And
I have to be vague.
I don't know. You know, it seems to me there's a thing called jury nullification here. I mean, let's suppose you said, I don't believe in the drug war. And there's some judges who said this, not many, but a few, who said, I'm not going to support this. I'm not aware that they were thrown off the bench. I mean,
they'll just get disqualified in every case.
Doesn't that send a message, though, to the rest of the judges? I mean, see, it seems to me that you can't get shit through the legislature about the drug war.
Well,
so what you need is the community to rise up and say, forget it. You may make a lot of money as an attorney, not you, but the entire legal system by playing this game and destroying the lives of thousands of people in our county each year by doing this. But we're going to say no. This judge said no. We're going to support this judge. We're going to demand every other court do the same. Now, that sounds like mob rule. Frankly, I call it democracy. If you can't get the legislature to respond, and you can't get the judges to respond, the people have to act.
And the jury is free to do what they want when they get behind closed doors.
Are you going to say that to them?
The jury knows that.
No, the jury usually doesn't know that. That's the problem.
And if the community sentiment is so strong and that they are so upset and angry about the procedure that's going on,
you would think
they can find a reasonable doubt.
You would think they would say not guilty or reasonable doubt.
Yes.
That's another issue, jury nullification. As you know, judges early in the constitutional history of our country, Supreme Court justices said, you know, jury nullification is a basic right. The jury has a right to examine not just the facts, but the law as well. Or if it considers the prosecutorial process improper, they can say not guilty, even if all the facts add up to guilty. They can say not guilty. But the gag rule, after, what is it, Worf versus Sparf, or whatever the hell, Sparf versus Hansen, it was an 1898 decision, has muzzled not just judges, but has also muzzled defense attorneys on this issue. You haven't told a jury, hey, guys, you can say no to this crap if you want, have you?
I've walked a fine line on it several times, but never been called on it, and had good results.
Good for you. Let's see here. Let's talk about your opponent. That's Ari Simons.
Correct.
What's Ari's experience compared to yours? What's her positions according to yours? We don't have her in the studio. I've invited her on the air to come in. I haven't called her office directly. I doubt she'd be interested, but who knows? You're invited, Ari, if you want to come in and have some time on the air. So,
she's a career prosecutor.
Mm-hmm.
Has always looked at the criminal justice cases from the prosecution standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
She's a good trial lawyer. She's a an effective advocate, and she has a completely different life experience than I. I don't know. I just look at the world differently.
What's the amount of money that you two have spent on your campaigns relatively?
My understanding is she's spent in the area of $130,000, $140,000. I've raised about $40,000 and spent about $58,000 because I put money in myself.
Huh.
I just did a mailer that cost me $22,000. That was an eye opener.
If you win, okay, what changes? Why should poor people vote for you?
Because I believe in equal and fair justice. Okay, and I believe that
under this system, how could you possibly have equal and fair justice?
Well, you know, under what system? Under what's the system of what we have, or the system what it should be?
A system of what we have.
Well, it's, you know, I've always fought for, I've always been fighting for those without. okay? I was 16 years a public defender.
Tell us about that.
And I would help every person that I was appointed to. And I've had private cases and public defender cases at the same time. You'll never know the difference between whether they're private or they're public, because I treat every client the same, and that is I do whatever is possible to help them benefit as best they can.
Now, I have trashed many a public defender on this show based on the experience that their clients have had with them. They don't give them enough time. They don't engage in the investigation they need to. They sell them out on plea deals and plea bargains. They don't allow their friends to come into conferences with them, even if they want to waive confidentiality so they can have support. They don't stand up for them in court often. And a lot of this has to do with the fact that, obviously, public defenders are overworked, they're underpaid, and all that sort of thing. But we have to also talk about the results. And if the results are public pretenders instead of public defenders, then we have to talk about the truth of the issue, not just what we kind of, you know, let's be nice to these public defenders because they're doing the best they can. I'm sorry, they're in a much better position than the poor schnooks that they're being told to defend, that they're claiming a defense for. They're not saying, I quit, I can't defend this person, because I don't have enough resources. I don't hear the public defenders saying that. You've been with the public defender's office, or you've been mostly private? What's been
16 years with the public defender's office.
Let's defend the please defend the public defender's
you know,
office.
I worked for Larry Bigham, Jerry Christensen, John Mitzloff for a number of years. Uh-huh. I have great respect for them as lawyers and as administrators. They also have a good training program. The problem with the nature of the public defender's office is like factory work. You have too many clients, not enough time. They cannot meet the needs of their clients. There's no question. They can't hold their hands. In general, they do as good as they can. There's some that try cases every single week, and they're diligent in doing that. Every time you try a case, it screws all your other pending cases because you're giving all that to one client, and there's 50 of them that go untalked to. So, I mean, the process is tough. And when I was a public defender, I used to work 12, 14 hours a day, all day Saturday, and just because to keep up with my workload and to try to meet the needs of my client the best I could. And, I don't know if you walk around, you hear a lot of people bad-mouthing me and saying, he was a crappy lawyer.
I have actually not heard people bad-mouthing you. But I invite people to call in and bad-mouth poor Steve. because we're going to go beyond Tuesday. Whether you're a judge or whether you're a lawyer, you're a person who works in this community on issues that are important. And you need the feedback of the people.
I do. I agree 100%.
And we need the feedback.
And I need exposure to new issues and to different thoughts, too. And, Robert, I want to say that I've been in this community since 72 working. And I've always known of you, okay? Mm-hmm. And I know that you're a tireless advocate, and I respect that a lot. And we're getting old. I'm just wishing there were solutions. It scares me that you're still fighting the same issues you were.
Scary, isn't it?
30 years ago.
It's weird.
And, sometimes there's going to be a solution, and I hope so.
Linda's apparently got a comment or question.
Yeah.
Linda, go ahead.
Mr. Steve Wright, I'd like to ask you, this is just your opinion, this question. What could you do differently if you were a judge to make the public defender system, at least here in our county, work more equitably? Less with the poor guy going into court knowing he's the poor guy.
Yeah, what needs to be changed, whether you're elected judge or not? What kind of reforms are necessary?
What could you do about that system?
Well, I don't think Steve's going to win. I hope he does, but I don't think he's going to win. So I want to know what he's going to do anyway.
Well, when you say that, that makes people think, well, why vote?
No.
But I tell you what, I disagree with you.
I understand. You're running for office.
I've always been an underdog.
I hope you win.
It's a fight on this level. These are the people that I know, and these people
every candidate who comes in here, I guess, has the same bone to pick with me, but frankly, the only candidates that are worth talking to are the ones who usually lose, unfortunately. So go ahead. I'm not assuming anything, but I'm saying that I'm more concerned what you're going to do, whether you win or lose. That's what I'm concerned about. Linda's question is, how can the public defender's office be?
You know, one of the things is that if I'm experienced, I've been doing this all my life, okay? I'm very effective in dealing with things. I think that one of the problems with a public defender's caseload is they spend so much time in the court, very little time in the office. You need to be able to be efficient in dealing with court cases and let them go. so that they have time in their office to deal with and prepare.
You need paralegals helping them, maybe? Or
sure, they need paralegals and they need investigators. When you have a lot of law in motion work that's required, it slows things down. If you can, lots of times I think there's cases where they're just a bad search right there. You should look at it and say, let it go, instead of going through all the litigation. And, you know, I think that with my experience and my knowledge of the law, I think I can help speed that process up and help reach reasonable, fast solutions.
You're running for office. You got 4 days left. What kind of help do you want? How can people reach you? How can they endorse you? How can they support you? What do you want? What's your pitch here?
The biggest thing they can do is talk to everybody or tell people about me and tell them why they support me. I have a website, which is Steve Wright, or is it www.stevewright?
Yes.
For judge.com. They can find out more about me on that. My phone number is 427-1115, my campaign office. I basically need people to get out to vote. I need people that care about this community and want a change and want some difference to talk to their friends and get them out to vote, too. Because everybody, rich or poor, has the same voting power. And she has the rich people.
Except in Florida, of course.
Except in Florida.
Hey, thank you, Steve, for coming in. And
hope
when I come before you, have mercy.
I will.
All right, thanks. That's about it for Bathrop Spears Broadsides tonight. And we have Linda in the studio here, too. And again, if you want to get a hold of Steve, give him a call, 427-1115, or go to stevewrightforjudge.com, or just go vote for him on Tuesday. Thanks, Steve. All right, man. Linda, you have about 30 seconds to make some comments before Uncle Dennis comes storming into the studio. We have to...
Well, I just have a reactionary comment. I'm glad I got to meet your guest, Steve Wright, because I really didn't know which way I was going to vote, and I've been influenced here. I met his opponent, if that's the word in this kind of race.
Ari Simons?
I've met her before, anciently, years ago, but I met her as a candidate in Davenport at the Cinco de Mayo celebration that the Resource Center there in CAB puts sponsors every year. And I was glad to see her there, but we weren't resonating, let's say, very strongly.
Uh-huh.
So I was hoping I get to meet Mr. Wright, and thank you very much.
You're welcome. That's it for Bathrop Spears Broadsides. It's now time for music galore and a few updates from Uncle Dennis, from the cream to the dregs. You can learn what his subversive green activists are doing to destroy life as we know it in our technologically advanced society. He'll be giving you updates probably around 9 or 9:30. He may have a couple of his subversive colleagues drinking beer in the studio with him.
Right.
We'll see how that plays out. Whether the studio stinks of beer the next time I come in here, we'll find out about that.
All anyway, active greens are not subversive.
Certainly. Well, he's not a green. He is a green activist.
I'm a green, and I heard what you
said.
You're
a Green Party hack, but that's another story.
We're not all hacks either.
We'll be talking about this next time.
Is there a Green Party?
There is no Green Party. There is Tim Fitzmaurice, who ran on the Green Party label and then sold out
the Greens.
I
have to correct you again. There is a Green Party.
There's
even a U.S. Green Party, but I'd rather not talk about that.
Two men for president and vice president.
Oh, pigs all, that's what I say.
No.
Wink, wink, city.
Greens get the vote for Cynthia McKinney.
That's true.
Not in California. She didn't make the primary.
Oh, no. Write her in. Don't vote for just guys.
This debate could go on forever. But
there.
The mamas and the papas are going to interrupt and provide an ample introduction to Uncle Dennis's show. Tune in next week, on Sunday, actually. I'll be coming back with more.
I wish it was next week.
Dennis is Dennis, as usual. Chris Worthington, a council member from Berkeley, should be on the air again talking about the Brown Act and what they're trying to do up there to make sure that people have access to public meetings. Thanks for being with me on this edition of Bathroom Spears Broadsides. Come to the Saturday Human Rights Organization meeting, 2 o'clock, Firefly Cafe, 131 Front Street, or give me a call on the Huff line, 423-HUFF. Linda, thank you for being with me.
Thank you.
Blueberries for breakfast, for breakfast.
Hope that's not light brown apple moth caterpillars in your trousers. You'd have to be sprayed, I suppose. Mamas and the Papas. Robert leaving us a little bit of the music of the M&Ps. Thank you, Robert. You'll be back Sunday, right, at 9:30, usurping more free radio airtime for your own personal vendetta upon the world.
Against Mayor Coonerty.
Against Mayor Coonerty. And the Bookshop Santa Cruz, from which you have been forever banned for an eternity and a day.
For life,
actually. Well, eternity and a day.
And a day.
Yes. Anyway. I'm Uncle Dennis. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1. For the next 3 hours, we're going to be listening to music of the 60s and the 70s. Let's start off with a little Eric Clapton.
don't care.